So during your presentation, we had a lot of great questions, a lot of questions online, and I'm sure many people in the room have some questions. So the format of this for the next half hour, again, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Scott.
I'll ask some questions from something that's been submitted online, and while they're answering that, if anyone in the room has a question, just get my attention and I'll bring the mic over to you.
You're going to be like the Richard Campbell where you run around with the mic. I like
that.
No. I like that.
I could never be Richard Campbell. Let's make that very clear.
Okay. All right, Scott.
All right. So let's start with David says, if I'm starting the development of a new cloud app, which Azure SQL SK, which SKU should I use? General purpose, hyperscale, or critical business?
Sure. I can take that one. I mean, classic answer, it depends. but if you're just getting started and you're just playing with it, I recommend starting with general purpose. However, the caveat I'll put on that is if you use the Microsoft Learn Sandbox, you can deploy any of those SKUs in Azure SQL Database and see what they're actually like and do all your testing, do all the stuff that you need. But most of our customers today are running on general purpose and not having any issues.
Nice.
All right. So Eric here in the audience has a question about licensing.
Licensing. Ooh. Oh,
yeah.
God.
That's you.
Oh, it was me. Okay. Sure.
This is great, but I got to make sure my boss says, how much more is this going to cost me? So is there a place I can go and give some stats or here's
sure.
cost differences, things along those
I'll
lines?
I'll take a shot at that. Is that okay, guys? Okay. So first of all, we do have a pretty good licensing guide for SQL Server itself. So SQL Server, including like containers, things of that nature. That guide gives you all the details for SQL Server. Of course, Azure SQL is a subscription-based offering where you're paying per compute and storage and so forth. But here's a nice tip for you, and Anna, why don't you chime in as well. You ever heard of Azure Hybrid Benefit? This is you taking existing SQL licenses and applying them to cloud subscriptions to save you money. You have some other thoughts about that. How do you get that Azure Hybrid Benefit thing?
Yeah, in addition to Azure Hybrid Benefit, which you can get using your existing SQL Server licenses, it's very easy. It's just a checkbox when you're selecting the SKU. You can also get reserved capacity, which is a way to prepay in advance and get a significant discount. Scott, I think we also had a question up here.
Before we go to that, just to follow on with that, on the cost side, there are cost estimators built right in when you go to the Azure portal. And you can get sliders and predict things. Also in the migration assistant, there's a whole bunch of tools in there that will take a trace of your workloads and tell you if you do this, this is what it looks like. So you can do an intelligent comparison. In some cases, the on-prem system may be cheaper. In other cases, the cloud may be cheaper. It's more about functionality than the specific cost. If you get what you need, then you're in good shape. And I think we had a question here.
Yeah, let's go online.
Okay, he's going to switch online to in person. Cool, Scott. Sounds good to us, man.
So while you're talking about money, there's a question on serverless.
Yes.
What happens when you try to connect to a serverless database and it's paused?
Sure, I can take that. So if you try to connect to a serverless database when it's paused, the first connection attempt will fail as we connect the storage and the compute back together. This usually takes about 30 seconds. One thing to keep in mind is that you are starting with a cold cache since SQL Server was essentially off.
But I guess the billing, Anna, right, is that you were paused, so you didn't pay for compute, right?
Exactly.
But then when you start going, I guess you pay, if you don't use it, you pay for min compute. You have a min range, right? And then you just pay what you use. Is that
exactly.
right? Yeah.
That's right. Yep.
I mean, that's the definition of serverless, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So the retry logic is important.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, Duke has a question live in the audience here.
Yeah.
Okay, so for the data science cognitive service, so I talked to a lot of folks, data engineer, like eBay, PayPal, or Costco. Mm-hmm. So when we do the search on the website, they cannot search the right product.
Okay.
So we have to go to Google and search the product.
I see.
Yeah. So I think like because they told me like using Microsoft Azure is difficult. It's not there yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So can you explain that?
Yeah. So the question was around searching on your own content. You want a Google or a Bing in your own environment. And so what you're looking for is Azure Cognitive Search. And so if you take a look at that, there's lots of documentation around that API. For a specific difficulty or something like that, I'd recommend we just take a look at the actual workload. But in general, that service has been improved a great deal. They may not have looked at it in a while.
Okay, Anna, this next question is about your demo. Can you talk about the difference, the differencing tool that came back? You had a select statement specifically on a version, like 191 or something. How do you get just the last diffgram?
Yeah, exactly. So I think what you're asking is how can you get the latest updates and only the latest
yeah,
updates?
Yeah, something so the, happened. Tell me what
right.
it is.
So yeah. the way that we did that is by using something called change tracking. And this is something available in the SQL engine, not just Azure SQL database. But that's going to allow us to, what we showed in the demo was actually how you can create a change table. And from that change table, we can specify, hey, for this user from a specific version, only give me the latest updates. Now, what you saw is we actually were using an API to hit that stored procedure and return the results. So that's how we were able to show visually exactly what has been updated or inserted or that sort of thing. And hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah. Okay, great. Deidre over here, live in the audience, has a question as well.
What if you start out with general purpose and then you find that you need business critical, but is that easy to transfer? And then what if you start with business critical because your boss told you to, and you realize to save money, you need to go to general purpose. Is that easy to do?
Adidra, first of all, do what your boss says, right?
Yeah.
So big important tip for you. Here's a great story between those. It is a simple deployment choice, either through the portal, or even T-SQL to make those choices. There is no migration required. Now, it depends on the choice and the changes you're making and the size of your database. So like, for example, general purpose, if it's a huge database, I got to go business critical, I got to give all those replicas going, right? But the other cool story that we have here is that the actual downtime is short because we try to go make a new deployment for you and then we switch you at the last second. But it's a declarative choice and it's actually really easy to make. So, Anna, is there any other thoughts? That's kind of like,
yeah, I think that makes sense. The only thing I would add to that is if there are scenarios where sometimes you need business critical and sometimes you need general purpose, because of this seeding stage, which is a size of data operation, it might make sense to implement some sort of automation. So you could use something like Elastic Jobs, which supports Azure SQL Database, to say, hey, we know during this time we really need that business critical database, so we're just going to implement some logic. So that might be a way if you kind of need both to kind of avoid. But yeah, if you're switching a lot and there's a lot of data, then there will be a time associated
with
that.
But let me add on a comment here. So I think it's really important. We try to do this as much as we can to explain these tiers, right? What they give you. So to be clear, you know, general purpose is going to be more for general workloads, reasonable IO performance, lower cost, but you get things like serverless. But remember, you still get built-in availability. You got like a failover cluster instance in this environment. That may be fine. So what Ann and I will oftentimes do when they talk about this comparison is what is your RTO and RPO needs? You got to go look at those kind of type things because business critical might be required to meet that. That may be alone the reason why you make that choice.
But. That's great. Thank you, everyone. So this one's a little different, right? We're hybrid, so we're both online and in person.
Okay.
I took a stab at answering this question online. So I'm going to ask you the question, but I'm also going to provide you my answer.
Oh, nice.
Because
so,
then
so Scott, we get to test you then.
That's right.
Part of this.
We
lovely.
Can just leave.
See you later.
All right. This is hybrid, right? So, okay. Terry Wilson online says, I'm not sure I still understand why I should use SQL Server with machine learning.
Mm.
Okay. So that's the scope. My answer was... Okay. Just like a stored procedure, we're building logic on the server. So we're letting the server do something.
Yeah.
And I then continued to say, like anything, this could be used for greatness or could be abused. So I'm sure there's some lines
sure.
in there. But a key advantage is that you can do machine learning where the data lives inside the database, which eliminates the need to sort of move my data somewhere else and bring it back.
Yeah, that's so, you've nailed it. There's a couple of primary reasons.
Yeah,
nicely done.
Scott, are you a data scientist?
I've got a session on this right after the lunch break, and so you can come give it. So the general idea is when you use machine learning on top of SQL Server, you're not moving the data around the network. So there's a performance hit there, which is awesome. But the other thing is there's a security profile. You're not having to move it off of the server. There's a secure channel right on the server that lets the Python, R, or Java, or whatever which work interactively with the data. You simply do a select statement past that, and it returns a data set, which is very nice as well. Another thing that's kind of interesting to keep in mind is that you've now got a separation of duties. So I let my database administrator control who has access to the data sets, and I let my data scientists create their model on a representative data set, but they never get to see the real data. They can see a representation of that data, but I can fudge numbers and so on. Then when I run it in the real system, I can now score it against data. And the interesting thing there is I could even say, for instance, Bob wants to call that stored procedure and see a certain amount of data. and Anna's got more privileges because she's better at her job. And so what I want to do is I want to punish Bob by not letting him see as many rows. He won't be able to score whether he's in the right percentile for his salary as Anna and I are, because we obviously make a lot more than he does.
Hey, one thing to add from a DBA perspective, and I've chatted with these folks about it, who are the true data scientists, I'm the DBA guy, is that I've had some customers get nervous about letting Buck Woody run their Python code on their SQL server. Like, right. They don't really want to do that. So resource governor is tied into this. You can control the resources that this stuff runs.
That's right.
From a CPU, memory, and even a thinnitization perspective. So I can actually limit Buck, which is a good idea, on what he can run as a Python on my SQL server.
Yeah, as you answered that, I have an application development background, and so I start thinking about the permissions of who has access to what. Is that governed by identity in the connection string? So when
no,
I go
it's
to
literally the SQL Server. So the same thing you do today in SQL Server, you do there. You can go fine-grained, even down to row level or column level security. Or if you're using programmatic security, it follows the same model. So for you as the developer, it's just dead simple. You just call a stored proc, goes into's and goes out of's, and then you get your answer back and you're done.
Nice. Can you elaborate on the job role that you talked about? Because I imagine now if I'm a database administrator that I've been working on this my whole life, am I now expected to become the data science? Like, I think I might know the answer to this, but I'd like to hear you elaborate on what does SQL Server actually do to get an answer from a model?
Yeah.
It's an HTTP request, or do I have to, how does that actually work?
Yeah, we have an extensibility framework, it's called. It's built right into the engine. There's a secure channel that allows the SQL Server engine, which does what it has always done, to simply send out a set of requests. Works slightly different in Linux and Windows, same end result. There's a series of processes that allows a separate and independent machine learning service to run and do the scoring and do the R work or the Python work or the Java work and transfer that back. No HTTP requests, no weird endpoints, no security things that you have to do that are special. So it's totally within the stored procedure or transact SQL code.
Okay, cool. That's great. Keep your questions coming live in the audience. We'll go somewhere else online, back over to LearnTV. So Ada asks, containers and Kubernetes are hot topics in the industry. When should I consider using this for SQL?
Okay, I'll take a first step.
Yeah, you take a first step. Yeah, you go for it.
So, you know, we kind of alluded a little bit on the slide there a little bit. One great scenario is for developers. Again, we talked about a dev server, a SQL server that developers share. I like to use that to kind of start with, even though containers can certainly run in production. That's what we'll talk about the kubes comment in a second. But again, imagine a world where your developers are all sharing a SQL server and they're just mucking it up. Give them a container image of SQL Server and scripts and stuff in their environment, Linux, Mac, Windows, and let them all develop off a consistent image, even in DevOps scenarios. Now you're like, well, I like that container concept. We talked about the patching, right? You could switch containers to patch SQL Server. I love this idea. It's pretty cool. I want to run it in production now. Well, what if you got like 100 of these things to run? That's where Kubernetes comes in. And in fact, a great example of running containerized production SQL servers is not just SQL Server Big Data Cluster, but our new Azure Arc offering. So containerizations have that portability, lightweight, consistency, great, less downtime story. If you're not using, let's say, public cloud services, and then for production container applications, including SQL, Kubernetes is the best way to host it. Buck, you have something to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. The container story for developers is the prime case that you'll see. I've got Anna, and she's developed something, and she says, I want you to try this, or I want to give you my application. She has to be concerned about what version of SQL I'm running, what version of Python I have, what libraries I have loaded, all kinds of things. Or she can simply say, there's my container registry, type this code, and you'll have it in less than 3 minutes. So that's just unbeatable for that. Then the portability side is actually big for me. As you pointed out, I can show someone on a Mac running SQL Server on a Mac in a container, and there's nothing changed. It works. It's the regular stuff inside SQL Server. So now I'm running in a Mac world, or maybe I want to do it in Linux, and while you can install SQL Server full up in Linux, maybe I still want that portability. Maybe I want to run it in some lesser cloud.
Right.
And maybe I want to run it there and they all have container services. Maybe I want to spin that up on the Azure cloud. So many places containers can run, even on Raspberry Pi. So this portability can't be underestimated. And You also want to think about that isolation. Like I said, Anna can give me a complete environment. Data scientists have been using this forever to get Python, because Python's just a mess with all the libraries and versioning and all that. And they're like, oh man, just bundle this up. And so now we can do that with the database as well.
Here's another thing, for a tip for you that asked the question on LearnTV. How would you like to actually pull down an image of this container? You do it offline, and then you start it, and you've installed SQL Server in 2 seconds. It's a pre-deployed version of SQL. There's no installation required.
No installation.
The deployment experience is amazing.
Yep.
One of the things that you mentioned in your talk to elaborate on the containers is a rollback scenario.
Yes.
That has a lot of dangers in my mind as an application developer, because I may be dependent on that new feature. And if something rolls back and I'm asking for, let's say I'm calling a stored procedure that doesn't now exist, I could orchestrate my application to roll back in its container as well as the SQL Server to roll back. Do you have real life guidance or practice on that? Maybe it's version control. Is that sort of the
answer? It's all about DevOps, right?
Yeah,
so
DevOps.
You're going to start building custom, what's going to happen in these environments now? Many people are going to start running these containers, not just as a SQL container. They're going to build on top of that container with the app, with the scripts, all the dependencies with them. And that's going to come together as a single image now. So in that rollback scenario, it's not going to just be rolling back SQL. It's rolling back to the right container that has SQL, the version of the app, everything that depends on it.
Yep. And the neat thing about this is we're all familiar with Transact SQL. It's a declarative language. Select star from table. That's, I'm assuming that's what all developers do, is just select star from table.
Please don't do that.
No. Yeah. Select star from table one, select star from
where
table
two.
Yeah, exactly.
Where,
where,
in there.
Where one equals one. So so they do this code, right? And we don't actually say file open, mem commit, file close, hard drive is at this location. We don't do any of that. We just say select F name from table, right? And it does it. It's a declarative language. This is what I want. And so containers are controlled by, of course, a YAML file, just a JSON file or text file rather. And all you do in there is you declare, I want SQL Server 2019 CU3.
Right.
You just say that. When you hit go, that's what happens. You don't have to say, oh, it's gotta be this and you gotta install it. You just say, I want that, and that will happen. And in Kubernetes, it goes another step. Then there'll be another YAML file that says, always make sure that's around, three of them. And if one goes down, literally, it will just stand another one up. You declare what you want. You declare your intent in a text file. So now let's talk about your developer scenario. You tell me, hey, Bob, I screwed this thing up really bad. I need you to roll back to yesterday. All you have to say is run this command.
So that will roll back the server. But then what about the data that happened for the last 24 hours?
Beautiful. That's the great story about this.
Yeah, look at him go.
Containers are often run in a shared storage environment, what's called persistent storage. So all of that's attached already to these containers. So the new container that comes up has the right version of SQL, and SQL Server is compatible to switch between cumulative updates for the same set of databases.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
So literally the storage just is the same? When you
switch to the new container, point to the same databases, and you're up and running.
And then the backup plan you talked about is backing up and timestamping the storage, which is independent.
Different storage location. That's correct.
Yeah. It's a great time to be a developer, isn't it?
It's a great time to be a dev.
Exactly.
Okay. A few more questions that we have online. Let's see. Let's go to, okay, this one's interesting. How do I decide if SQL Edge is right for my application?
I'll start with that one a little bit. Think in terms about what we're doing with SQL Edge. We're providing a containerized version of SQL Server that is specifically optimized to run on small things. So if you need to run a SQL.
That's IoT. Like,
that's IoT,
when you say small
right?
things, that's
again,
that's
think about like a
world.
Drone or think about like a manufacturing device. Think about a Raspberry Pi. We literally took the SQL Server code. I liken to a movie I saw one time where they were trying to figure out how to take an airplane and launch it off an aircraft carrier that wasn't meant to launch off an aircraft carrier. It's a famous movie, right? So they had to figure out how to rip everything out of this plane to get this thing to take off. And one of it was like they took the guns and put black broomsticks, painted broomsticks, right? In other words, they stripped this down to the bare components to run it and lift it off an aircraft carrier. That's a little what we've done with Edge. We've actually stripped down all the stuff that's not needed to run the core engine to reduce the footprint so it can run on a Raspberry Pi or a small device. So your first decision to make is, do I even need that? Do I need to take the data processing and machine learning capabilities and run it on the device itself, or do I just need to feed telemetry up to the cloud and run it up there? So it all starts with, where does this app need to live? And do you really need data processing capabilities on the edge? One of the reasons why customers said they wanted it, 3M's that example, they have IoT devices that are semi-connected. In other words, they have a lot of telemetry feeding for these, but they can't afford to just send it to the cloud all the time and have something else process it and give them a result. They need to do prediction analysis at the machine itself when it may not be connected to the internet. So what better tool than the SQL Server engine to process data and do machine learning services?
And one of the wonderful things about SQL Edge is we've built in integrations with things like Azure Stream Analytics, IoT Hub, so not only, and new time series capabilities. So if you take a manufacturing environment and you have to do some sort of predictive maintenance, now you can be in a semi-connected or disconnected state and actually make the decisions, deploy your models to the device, and make decisions without being connected.
So would you guys agree, like you're data scientists, you might go take your machine learning models and train them in your workstation or somewhere else.
Big iron. We use big iron.
With representative data from the IoT devices.
Right.
And then you would push down your models onto this IoT device. And it doesn't have to be connected, and you could run your models.
Yeah, the models are very tiny. Think of an Excel formula almost. That's basically what they end up being, a very tiny binary model.
Right.
To train them, you need terabytes of data. The more data, the better. Right? So you don't put that on the device. You train it somewhere else. Think about it for a moment. When you went to school, you learned to read. And they gave you tons and tons and tons of books as you learned to read. But you don't carry those around today. You know how to read. You have a machine learning model in your head of, I know how these words work. That's exactly what we do in IoT. When we're back on the server and we're training it, we're giving it tons and tons and tons of library books. When we take the model, we're just putting just that on the IoT device. A lot of times when you need edge real-time predictions or classifications to make life or death decisions.
You know what? That is probably the best explanation of machine learning that I've heard. It's so simple.
Machine learning for the rest of us? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, machine learning for the rest of us. I'm just going to ask you, can you just repeat that same thing? Literally,
sure.
You mean the
reading
book
example again.
The book analogy.
Sure.
The reading.
Yeah, there's even a simpler one. This is, I teach data science around the world, and this is even a simpler one. When we have a child, we show them a cup. Here's a cup. Here's a cup. Here's another cup. And we show them different kinds of cups, and the child hears us say that word. And then we get another object that isn't a cup, and we say ball or toy. Then we show the child a cup it's never seen, and we say, what is this? And the child says, cup, but it's not a cup. And we say, no, this is not a cup. This is a toy. What is this? Toy? Yes, very good. So that's exactly how machine learning works. We run the data past it. It's pre-scored. We know the answer. And we say to it, this is a cup, this is a cup, this is a cup, this is a cup, that's a ball, that's a toy. And we move forward. Then we show it data it has not seen, but we still know the answer. And this is called test data. And we say, what do you think this is? And it says, cup. And we go, no. And we penalize it and give it a score. And it says, oh, that one must be, okay. And it learns. Then we can show it randomly later another object and say, is that a cup? And it can say, I'm almost certain. That's a cup. That's literally how machine learning works.
I feel like I've been machine learning my whole life.
So I'll throw a shameless plug in here. If you like Buck's explanations and you want more of these types of explanations, Buck and I have actually started a mini series called Something Old, Something New on Data Exposed. And it comes up once a month. We've done about six episodes so far. So you can go through and see from a data perspective or a data professional perspective, how can you take those steps towards machine learning? And plus, Buck wears all these crazy
shirts. Isn't it really I just tune in for the entertainment part of it, actually.
So the something old, something new. The something old is obviously the math. And then Anna shows the code, which is the something new.
Wait, you're not the something?
No. It's old? The math is old and her code is new. What did you think?
I thought
you were the old and she was the new.
Oh, okay. If you want to see it right now, aka.ms/SOSN. Something old, something new.
Nice.
And you are also partnered with us. That runs live on Learn TV. So we get data exposed.
Absolutely.
Weekly.
Yep.
Learn just keeps giving for us, man.
Yep.
what can I say?
It's a great partnership. You have good content. We have good infrastructure.
That's true.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's true.
That's perfect. Okay. Let's go back to SQL Server and specifically talk about SQL Server not on Azure. So we talk a lot about Azure SQL.
Yes.
What about the future of just SQL Server on-prem and what love do we have there?
Yeah, in a typical Microsoft fashion,
yep.
I'll give you a long answer. So as you know, we released the latest version of SQL Server in 2019. Funny story, though, is that being part of the engineering team, we always start working on the next version of SQL Server before we ship a version of SQL Server. So we were already starting to think about the next version of SQL Server as we were releasing SQL 19. Obviously, we're here in June of 2021, and you're like, Bob, what's the story? Like, what's going on, right? We always innovate on the product. We talked about how the core engine's the same in the cloud. So what's happening is a lot of things what we're doing is we're investing that show up cloud first end up on a major release of SQL Server. As it turns out, in the engineering team, if we wanted to, we could build and release SQL Server as a version once a month if we wanted to, but nobody's gonna buy that, right? So it's a process of us deciding, have we provided enough value in a release cumulative together to warrant a new release of SQL Server, and is it ready from the perspective of that? So stay tuned, we're working on it. We don't have any kind of dates to reveal today, but we are actively discussing it. We do it like all the time. We're actively having that conversation.
Yep. And the underlying question may be, are you trying to move us to the cloud and are you leaving the on-prem? The answer is no.
Definitely not. Think about also the future is our slide I showed at the very end, right? I'm giving you information about the themes of what we're doing. Imagine a SQL Server, like a next version, that is very cloud connected, that's very integrated with the Azure experience. But we talked about things like intelligence, right? And analytics and so forth. We have found that those features, those capabilities are very popular with customers. We talked about modern developers, right? We want to meet to them. So imagine us continuing to iterate on those kind of themes and delivering those kind of capabilities with the future of our product.
All right, next up we have, we're gonna put you all three on the spot one after another.
Okay.
Anna, what is your favorite SQL Server feature?
Oh, favorite.
It can be cloud too, right? Or has it got to be SQL Server?
I mean, it says SQL Server, but
okay,
we'll take
SQL
any answer.
Server,
you're on the hot seat now.
Ooh, hot
yeah, you
seat.
Are on the hot seat, Anna.
Let me think.
I like that. I'd like to see your sweat, actually.
Can we tag back and I'll think about
okay,
it?
Okay, there
oh
you go.
Oh my gosh, what is this,
too
a wrestling
much pressure
match?
Going
seriously. Seriously.
Really?
Come on.
All right, Bob, what's your favorite
SQL
Server?
Oh, I'll go right
feature?
At it. It's accelerated database recovery. I mean, so
okay.
can I
now tell us what that is?
Oh, yeah. Can I really tell you what that is? Okay.
Yeah, you have 2 minutes.
Here we go. Okay, 2 minutes. Okay, here we imagine. Buck Woody comes in and deletes a billion rows in a transaction and causes my business to go down. Anna tries to kill him. I mean, his session, and we're still down. And then Pedro Lopes comes along and tries to crash SQL Server, and we're all down for like 5 minutes. And they call me in support and say, what do I do? And I say, use accelerated database recovery because all those problems go away.
So
that's the explanation.
I would imagine then there's a transaction log somewhere.
There is.
That then lets you go back to like a certain point in time.
It's all version based. We're using the power of versions in the SQL database to avoid long recovery and long rollbacks because we don't want Buck and Anna to bring our business down. That's really what it comes
down
to.
It's true.
So it seems like that's not a good enough answer because at the same time, if I'm a retail environment, other good things happened there. So is it binary? Like, if you go back to last Sunday, how do I keep some of the good stuff? Do I have
Here's the deal. This is a great. Thank you for asking that question. These versions are not for restore versions. These versions are for changes so that we can undo. When you're ready to undo, we undo.
So
it's
you can
only used. These versions are only used when you need certain versions of information based on locking, or you need to do crash recovery or undo. So imagine the failover scenario we drew for you in our diagrams, right?
Yeah.
That failover, when we come across to even a replica, an AG replica, we're always redoing changes on this replica, but we haven't undone anything that's not committed. Now, because we have versions, the undone happens in the snap of your fingers. So it really improves your uptime.
So what you're saying, I think, is if Buck somewhere last Wednesday deleted a billion rows and we just found out about it on Sunday, you could just roll back that one transaction from those deletions from
It's
Buck.
More of a live scenario. Let's say Buck did it on Wednesday,
yeah.
Right? And Anna says, oh my gosh, you've blocked the world because you deleted a billion rows. We need to roll you back because we got to undo that, right?
Yeah.
So she starts to do it, but we're all down during that operation.
Right.
It's all about availability.
Yep.
It's about availability during these rollback operations or undo operations for consistency.
Right.
All right, let's take a quick question from the audience.
No, can you repeat the word accelerated? What?
Accelerated database recovery. So here's one quick answer for you, though. Thank you for mentioning again that term. I call it ADR. Guess what? In the cloud, just works, just there. You don't even know it's there. But in SQL Server, we're a little more conservative, so you got to turn it on for your given database to use it.
Does it comes cost with SQL more 19. To use it, or I'm paying for that with the license of SQL
It comes
Server.
With SQL Server. It's just a database configuration option for SQL 19. And then the cloud, it just works.
Nice. All right, Buck, favorite SQL Server feature?
Oh, machine learning services. Yeah, so the ability to run Python, R, Java in the database, in a stored procedure for all the reasons we described. And then one part of that we didn't mention is the predict T-SQL statement, which is part of that.
That's right.
Which you don't need to do any of those things. You can simply call this predict statement
built in the
and
engine.
Off you go. Built right into the engine very fast.
So go into a little bit more detail on what that predict T-SQL is. I'm imagining some answers, but tell me more what it is.
Yeah, so we showed you the ability to run Python and R, and you have to like start a stored procedure. You put your R code or your Python code, you put it in the stored procedure. It then sends it off to that engine and gets the response back. But somebody had to write the Python and the R code. So now you've got to figure out how to be a data scientist and learn statistics and do all kinds of stuff. You don't want to do that. But you would like to predict things from inside Transact SQL because you're a T-SQL developer. If you have created a model, and we include several, that you have done already, that can be stored as a binary object in a table. Mm. And then I can simply say, use that object, send it these things, and give me an answer. One line, predict.
Integrated into the select
integrated
statement.
Integrated right into the select statement.
So you hit it right on the head. As a developer, I'm comfortable with T-SQL. Like, I'm not afraid of that.
And right.
I know unions, I know selects, I know joins.
Yeah. Right.
So I'm comfortable making choices there. But I also, like, now I understand a little more machine
learning.
It's another
function
from
in
your
T-SQL.
Description.
That's what it is.
But I don't know how to write that function.
Right.
So
nor should you, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nor should you.
We'll let somebody else have that job.
Yeah. Well, they already have it. And so the idea is not. And I want to go back to something you asked a little bit earlier. Should I become a data scientist as a DBA? A lot of times we think, oh, I'm a DBA. Therefore, I must become a BI developer.
Like I have to own everything.
Therefore, I must. My next thing is no, not at all. DBAs are great. Power BI and business intelligence, that's great. The idea of having data science on top of that, that's great. But you don't need to evolve to those skills. Those are separate skills.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
But wait a minute, Anna's on the hook now. Still.
Yeah.
Well, okay, we got to do another question.
Too bad.
She gets more time. She gets more time.
It's only available in SQL 2019 above.
So the question was, what versions do we have machine learning services? So in 2016, 17, we introduced
16
for R, the R language.
17 Python.
2017, we added Python. In 2019, we extended this extensibility framework to where you could use other languages. One of the ones we included was Java, but you could add more. You want Go? You can get Go. Anything you like. I'm doing a session just after Anna's today on secure machine learning with SQL Server. You might want to stay for that, and we'll cover that framework in perpetuity. Now, don't walk off.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No.
Yeah,
this isn't fair.
We have four minutes left, so let's wrap up with Anna.
Sure. So I'm going to take a tangential answer. So my favorite part about using SQL Server is the tools that come with SQL Server.
Sure.
So for example, Azure Data Studio forked off VS Code. It's awesome to use. Very easy to use. Has all these cool extensions like notebook capabilities.
Oh, you're the notebook.
Coming from a data science world and getting SQL notebooks in Azure Data Studio has been an awesome experience. SQL CMD to go to the command line and just connect and run queries and do things like bulk copy and inserts and all that stuff. The tools are just awesome, and the tools community is really great. I love that Azure Data Studio is all on GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I have an issue, I can go file it, and within, you know, like an hour, someone's saying, hey, we're working on this. Someone says, I've seen this too. Or they say, we're going to fix it. Go check the insider's build. So I think the tools is what helps make accessing all the capabilities of SQL Server very accessible.
That's a great answer.
Absolutely. That is a great answer.
Our tools team is watching live going, thank you.
Yeah. I love our tools team. Yeah.
As a developer, I can think back, I don't know how long ago, but I had one aha moment that literally changed my development career going forward is when I found out about SQL Server Trace Listener. And I'm like, wait a minute, I can have this disconnected item on the side that's only on when I want, and then it will tell me everything SQL Server is doing. It's almost like that beginning of that transaction log where I got to see that. And that was one of the tools that tremendously increased the value of my SQL performance. Okay, we've got room for one last question, which actually fits into what all three of you are talking about. And it very simply says, what are the monitoring options in Azure for SQL Server? Because I think that ties back to your recovery.
Yep.
It ties back into ML and usage. You don't want somebody spending too much time or money and tooling to actually see the monitoring. So Maybe
let me start.
Yeah, Bob's got to take.
Let me start
one.
With some core stuff, and then I'd like Anna you to comment about some of our new stuff we've done. So this is one of the things I try to emphasize to everybody live here in the room. The power of SQL Server Engine from a monitoring perspective. You just mentioned tracing, right?
Yeah.
All of that is in Azure SQL. Let's take managed instance for a second. You have all the DMVs, the query store, all the X event tracing, everything you need exists in the engine. So all the normal tools just work. But that is inside SQL, right? So that experience you're used to today is going to be available to you. Anna, why don't you talk about some of the new experiences we have outside of SQL?
Yeah, sure. A big new thing that we have is called Azure Monitor for SQL Insights. And this is going to allow you to kind of look at all your, at least Azure resources today, all your Azure SQL resources, VMs, MIs, DBs, even your secondaries, if you have an AG deployed in SQL Server and an Azure VM, or if you're using GeoReplicas, we can identify those secondaries as well. And you can actually see all of the metrics. It's actually really cool. I think we demoed it at some point during this conference.
I'm sure we have.
But if you're online and you want to go watch a video, we do have a deep dive on monitoring with the monitoring PM, Elaine Dormel, on our Data Exposed YouTube
It's pretty page. Stunning the amount that's there.
But think about this. So your monitoring experience inside SQL is what you're used to know and love. But you use Perfmon today. You're like, where is that thing? Because you don't have access to the OS and PaaS, right?
Right.
Hence SQL Insights. It has that look and feel, a performance monitor, and it's customizable. It's using Telegraph and Grafana and writing to something called Azure Log Analytics. Even ISVs can then hook into what that looks like and do their own type of visualization. It's a great story.
It's an amazing ecosystem. All right. Well, I appreciate your time, Buck and Anna and Bob. Please.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Appreciate
you
online.
Thanks, everybody online. Appreciate it. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for joining us.